Hi, I'm Susie Larson. Here's the podcast for Live the Promise. Enjoy the conversation. Good afternoon. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Susie Larson, and this is Live the Promise. And we are here to help you engage in a strong and active walk of faith. So glad you tuned in, and welcome to the weekend edition. Hope you're having a great, great weekend. Well, here's a rhetorical question for you. Do you find it difficult to forgive someone who's committed a wrong against you? How about this one? How long do you nurse a grudge? How often do you rehearse and rehash offenses against you? Well, my guest today is Wilma Dirksen, and she joins me to explain how, with God's help, she overcame her broken heart, and she actually drove out fear with the power of forgiveness. And she shares how we can be filled with love and forgiveness regardless of our circumstances. You're going to want to hear what she has to say. Before we get to that conversation, a few quick announcements. If you've not taken advantage of our Faith Radio app, I really want you to, because it's free. And I think we've got about 40,000 people who've already taken advantage of this great app. You can tune in and live stream to our programs from anywhere around the world. It's available in the Apple App Store or on Google Play. You know, you can even catch podcasts on that app after the fact. Check it out. So go to either Apple App Store, Google Play, and search Faith Radio Network. That's it. Also want to give a shout out to friends maybe listening on one of our new signals. We're so excited. We're brand new in Bismarck, North Dakota on the 89.1 FM signal. And we love, kind of have a tradition on Live the Promise, love to do this. So whenever we add a new market, we just want to hear from you and want to hear from our first listeners in that new market. So here's what I want you to do. If you're listening in from the Bismarck area on 89.1 FM, we would love for you to email me, Susie@myfaithradio.com. Give me your address. And the first two of you to email me, I will grab some books off of our Faith Radio shelf, write you a note. It's just a way of saying thank you for listening. I'd love to hear from you. But maybe you're also tuning in on 94.1 FM in Hartford. That goes for you as well. 93.1 FM in Waterloo, or 104.7 FM in Madison. Or maybe you're tuning in brand new on one of our FM signals in the Twin Cities, 90.7 FM or 97.5 FM. Or you're streaming online on that fabulous app I was telling you about. If you're brand new to the Faith Radio family, and specifically brand new to Live the Promise, I want to hear from you. Email me, Susie@myfaithradio.com. Put new listener in the subject line. Don't forget your mailing address. And I will grab some of those names, get some books off of our Faith Radio shelf, and get something in the mail to you soon as I am able. All right, let me tell you about my guest. We'll get her on the show. Wilma Dirksen is an international speaker and consultant on victimization and criminal justice. She's told her story and facilitated support groups of survivors of homicide, organized dialogues between victims and inmates in prison. She's conducted trainings, given lectures, even participated in panel discussions, and presented her insights to justice systems and addressed victims' needs at restorative justice conferences throughout the U.S. and Canada. We are honored to have her with us today. Dear Wilma, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Susie.
Mm-hmm. Well, we love to start out by talking scripture, and you chose Isaiah 30, verse 21. Whether you turn to the right or to the left, your ears will hear a voice behind you saying, "This is a way. This is the way. Walk in it." Talk about that passage and why you chose it.
Well, it was shortly after the murder of our daughter when I and my husband had chosen to forgive that we realized we didn't have a clue what that meant. Especially in the face of something so big and so awful. And we had been told, you can't get through this, it's going to destroy you. And so I just thought, I don't know how, I don't know what to do. And it was in the middle of the night, and I just reached over for my Bible and said, God, how am I going to do this? And my finger landed on this verse, can you believe it? And I just thought, oh, I'm just going to walk, and God is going to tell me from behind. And I think at that point I needed that. There's sometimes when we need to have knowledge ahead of time. But often we just, when it gets so dark, we just got to keep moving. And God's there right behind us, telling us and showing us the way.
Yep, this is the way. Walk in it. Well, I want you to tell us, Wilma, about your family before the tragedy struck your house. Tell us about just your family life.
Oh, we were a happy family. Cliff was a program director at a big camp, and I was a wannabe writer, and Candace was 13, Odia was 9, and Cyrus was 2. And our 13-year-old was a sanguine personality. She's just full of life and loved people. And all I can think of is that we were poor as church mice, but boy, did we feel rich, and we just were full of life.
Mm. Okay, take us to that day of what happened. You were working on a writing project.
Yes, and Candace called, and I was behind, like writers are, and I said, can you walk home? And she said, yes. She was very happy because her crush of the day, David, had given her a face wash with snow, and she was just flying high, and I could tell by her voice. And so I felt okay to say, can you walk home? And when you come home, the party will begin, and your best friend's coming tomorrow, and we're going to go pick out all the junk food you want.
Wow.
And then she didn't come home from school.
And what point did you realize that something was awry?
I came up around, you know, the time clock, I think, out, you know, our inner time tells us the time. So I came up kind of when I thought she should be through the door. And she wasn't. I looked at the time, and I just knew almost immediately there was a squall outside, a blizzard came in. It was really weird, so I knew that the weather had changed drastically from when I had been earlier in the day. It had been nice, warm. All of a sudden, it was blizzarding, and the cold front just moved in. And just that horrible cold feeling of, oh, Candace would not run away, not today, nothing. Nothing would keep her from home today, and she wasn't there. Just awful.
Mm. And then at some point, you call the police. Tell us what happened next.
We called the police, and they came over around 11 o'clock. We just begged them. We said, you know, her best friend is coming over. She just wouldn't run away today because they just expected that to be the case. And they came, and we just begged them, and they more or less told us that we were the problem, but they would put on a minor alert. But we had to be satisfied with that. And that was the beginning. And then the next morning, by then, you know, it was so, we were desperate. We were calling our friends. We were calling everybody. And finally, Cliff called the camp director at the time, and he just knew Candace and Heidi's relationship, knew immediately something was wrong, knew she wouldn't have run away, and then started the community search that lasted for 7 weeks.
7 weeks. I'm trying to think, dear Wilma, how you processed that and how the enemy attacked you at your moment when you were weakest, because Candace asked for a ride home, you're writing, and I mean, that's an everyday occurrence in the life of a parent. You know, is this an okay day for you to walk home? But in this case, this, you know, a tragedy struck. So how did you process the if-onlys?
Oh, well, you know, I was, thank goodness, I was in kind of denial. I was in kind of work mode and survivor mode. The guilt didn't hit me till a year later.
Wow.
And that was devastating, and I needed that year, I think. Well, it was at the anniversary of the day when I looked up and I saw her fingerprints and the image of guilt. All of a sudden I thought, I could have saved us all from this if I would have only picked Candace up. You know, I thought I was a good mother, and in previous experiences if Candace was in danger, I instinctively knew. So I went through all, hadn't I been close to God during that moment?
Mm.
What had I, you know, why hadn't I finished that stupid assignment earlier? You know, just all of the things. If I was a perfect mother, I would have known, and I would have picked her up.
Wow.
And none of this would have happened, and all the guilt.
You know, it's a marvel to me, Wilma, that it hit you a year later. I almost wonder if part of that is shock that kind of inoculated you from even, I mean, you probably couldn't have even have coped with that thought, given what you were going through when it was still so fresh, you know?
I think you're right.
Mm. So,
and people would say, well, I hope you're not blaming yourself. And I say, oh, no, obviously somebody abducted her. I mean, we all know that. I would sort of get mad at them. What do you think I'm to blame? But boy, when it came, did it come.
Wow. So you went 7 weeks not knowing where she was. And then tell us what happened after that.
Well, it was, of course, an unexpected day. We were at our wit's end, but kind of moving into, okay, after 7 weeks, according to psychologists, any abnormal becomes normal. And I think that that's kind of where we were when all of a sudden we were at the police station dealing with something, and they took my husband aside, Cliff aside, and told him first. And then Cliff told me, and I didn't believe it. I thought they're playing games with us. We had by this time had a healthy suspicion of some of the things that the police had done and hadn't done, and so I thought they were playing games. And it took them a while to convince me, and then we went and had to identify her body. Mm. Oh my word, that was tough.
I can't even imagine. So they found her, and is this right, in a shed? Is that right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. With her.
Her hands and her feet had been tied, mm-hmm. and she had been, we couldn't tell the motive, but she was hogtied, which of course starts to indicate, but we didn't find that out for years and years. And then, she had died of hypothermia.
So they hogtied her, put her in the shed, and in this freezing cold weather. And did you ever determine the motive?
Yes.
You did?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's, BDSM. It's a type of sexual assault. It's when somebody ties somebody up for their sexual pleasure.
Wow. Okay, we're going to get to more of the story on either side. Talking to Wilma Dirksen, author of the book, The Way of Letting Go, One Woman's Walk Toward Forgiveness. Malcolm Gladwell actually wrote the introduction to this book. We're going to hear the rest of this story, what this process was like, what was there justice served, what it was like for Wilma to start to heal again. If you want a copy of this book, email to get in on the drawing, Susie@myfaithradio.com. Don't forget your mailing address. Title of the book, again, is The Way of Letting Go, and we will be back in a minute.
Your body.
Really glad you tuned in today. I'm Susie Larson. This is of The Promise. My guest is Wilma Dirksen, author of the book, The Way of Letting Go, One Woman's Walk Toward Forgiveness. And something happened to their family. A tragedy struck one random Friday in a November day, 1984. It was her 13-year-old daughter, Candace, did not return home from school. 7 weeks later, after Winnipeg's most comprehensive missing person search, Candace's body turned up in a shed. She was bound at her hands and her feet, left to die in the plunging temperatures of that winter's first extreme cold front. Wilma, take us to that point of the story again. And I asked you right before the break if you ever identified a motive, and we are kind of going right into break. So maybe reset, if you would, and tell us what you learned about the offender's motive against Candace.
Well, we didn't really know for 23 years who would have done something like this.
Wow.
Or they didn't even have a strong suspect, till all of a sudden the story started to emerge. And that's when we found out that about the hog tying, about there was pubic hair. There's not a whole lot of evidence, except it does just have an indication of sexuality. Mm. And that was the most, 'cause, and she's a 13-year-old child with nothing else. Mm. So that's the only thing that is there for us to make sense out of it.
So how long did it take for you to identify the person who did this, or did you ever?
It was 23 years after that they charged him with first-degree murder. And then we've been going through trials, and the first trial, they said he was guilty, the verdict was guilty. But now we are in our second retrial, and we still don't know what the verdict is, actually. So it's been 33 years, and we still don't have the definitive answer, and it's just been a long journey.
Mm, my goodness. And at one point, your husband actually had to go through lie detector tests and actually was concerned, probably more than you realized, that he might go to prison. And I seem to remember in the book where he finally kind of exhaled and said, okay, I'm so glad that's not going to happen, and you realized how he'd been carrying that. Talk about that part of the story.
Well, that was 23 years after the police said they wanted to come and see us, and they said, we found him. And again, I had, they played games with us sometimes, as police do and need to do. I have no I can understand it in hindsight. And I just thought they're going to charge him, or that's a way of making him confess or you know, act strange. So that was 23 years later, and then they told us that they had a suspect and that they were going to charge him and needed us to be ready for that. There were four gentlemen that came to our house, and I'll never forget that day. And that's when they left. Cliff and I couldn't believe the relief and how the cloud just lifted from our lives. We didn't even know the cloud was there.
Mm. Wow. And bless your husband's heart for probably privately carrying that weight more than, you know, I mean, internally, I can imagine what that did, just tying his gut up in knots. And, you know, you said this, and I've read this, that usually when you lose a child, I mean, divorce seems to happen almost automatically because the couple turns against each other. They don't know what to do with such a wretched pain. How did you, as a couple, process this?
Well, this is where we started forgiving even before Candace was found. And I had learned about forgiveness. It was part of my understanding, my belief, my peoplehood. And people don't realize, they think that it's all about relationships. But to me, it's about letting go of something, or even generically, because I didn't let Cliff touch me for 6 weeks after Candace disappeared, because I was so angry at sex. I thought Candace had been taken. She's a 13-year-old. I just identified the blame as sexuality and men, and I just couldn't be intimate with my husband just visualizing Candace being raped.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had to, and Cliff felt the same way. We just couldn't be intimate, something that had been very strong in our lives and is needed in marriage. It's a good thing. It's not a bad thing. And so that was when we first said, okay, we've got to forgive. This isn't about us. We have a good life, and we have to retain everything. We've got to let it go. We've got to let go of our anger and let go of this feeling of revulsion and enjoy the pleasures of life. Very, very difficult.
Wow. So would you say that was some of the first steps towards letting go, was just within the context of your marriage? It seems like most of life transformation happens in the small space and works its way out. Would you say that was one of your first big steps of letting go, so that you could get near to each other again?
Totally, yes.
Wow.
That was one of the biggest ones, I think, right in the beginning, and manifested itself so early. I think there was a lot of letting go and forgiving the police because of their accusations, and they're not moving when we wanted them to move. And then, you know, friends never say the right things at the right time. And nobody gets it right, you know. It's just, and so there's a lot of forgiving that we have to do right along, and just say, oh, you know, they meant or they didn't mean, or I know that it's coming from someplace, and I'm just going to let it go. I'm not going to let it affect my life, because we have to be strong for, at that point, the motive was we have to be strong for Candace.
Wow. And I want to know what it was like for you in your walk with the Lord during this time. Did the heavens seem silent, or was there some extra grace kind of shoring you up? What was that like?
There seemed to be extra grace. Because the night that Candace disappeared, I had a kind of moment when I thought that there was wind in the house, and I didn't realize there was wind, and then all of a sudden the wind stopped, and it was about 4 o'clock at night, and I just said, oh, Candace, are you okay? And she said, yes, Mom. Totally an out-of-body kind of experience that I didn't know if it was right or not, but I couldn't discount it totally, and I couldn't believe it. So, but it was kind of something that God gave me. And at that point, not knowing where Candace was, I had no time to be angry with God. I needed a higher power. I needed all forces. So I needed to be in partnership with my God. So I just went full hog, just praying and saying, God, I will do anything. Just bring be with Candace. And I was in a real place of submission and desperation.
Mm. And, you know, okay, we've got probably, I think we've got about 3.5 minutes to that bottom of the hour break. But talk about how, you know, you did have to find a new normal in those 7 weeks. What was life like for you during that time?
Well, I don't think we actually reached the normal, because it was just full-time media, full-time search, full-time just living for finding Candace. And that became our normal. But I think that what we had to do is keep telling each other that we loved each other, and that was our desperate need for normal.
Wow. And you said, you know, there's times when I'm sure friends don't know what to say, and they say things that aren't helpful. What was actually helpful?
Oh, they brought everything. They brought buns, and then somebody would bring buns, somebody would bring borscht. The gift, everybody gave their best, it was a perfect buffet of food and prayers and perfect words. Oh, our friends just amazingly fed our need for attention, for grief, for comfort. It was truly lovely.
Mm. Talk to me, if you would, about fear, and maybe if you need to pick this up on the other side, please feel free. But did fear kind of amp up for you when you realize what's happening in your own family?
Fear is huge.
Yeah.
Fear is the biggest thing, and it takes on horrible, grotesque manifestations. And my big decision was, if I let fear rule my life, I would become a monster mother. Because I took out my fear on my children. I just became a horrible mother because I was so afraid that something would happen to them. And then I realized I'm worse than anybody else. Mm. That's fear.
So you had two other children still, and so you were reacting in fear to them because of what had happened with Candace. That's completely understandable. How did you navigate that then?
Well, I just kind of decided that no more fear. I was the monster, and to let fear go and to give them to God and say, I'm going to risk it. If they die, I went to the worst case scenario. If they die, all of them, and each one of them had a near-death experience during that time. Mm. And each time I would say, okay, it's okay, God. You can take them just like you took Candace, and I will continue to trudge this horrible journey that there is. And I'm going to try and make the best of it. Just give them over to the risk.
You know, it really is something. You sometimes, I think, to defeat fear, you got to look it in the square in the face and even look past it. Because I think that trying to get your arms around it or to try to avoid it gives it way too much power, doesn't it?
It is. You almost have to dance with it. You know, you have to. I always want to be on the safe side. But there has to be a balance of between what is good fear and what is trauma fear. And good fear gives us energy, it gives us life, and there was a lot of good fear that was happening. But the trauma fear is what isolates us, imprisons us, and turns us into actually the Green Hulk, you know, the emotions. And fear can turn into anger very quickly.
Wow. You know what? When we come back, I want you to make that distinction because you do lecture a lot and you help families sort through such incredible loss and injustice. I want to know a little bit more about the difference between good fear and trauma fear. What's the fruit of good fear? What's the result of trauma fear? And then we're going to get into some of these letting goes, letting go of my fear, my grief, my ego, my narrow faith, the old me, my expectation that life is fair, my guilt and my blame, my need to know, my rage, my obsession with my offender, my justice fantasy, my self-pity. We're going to talk about some of those when we come back. Talking to Wilma Dirksen, title of her book, The Way of Letting Go. Email if you want in on the drawing, Susie@myfaithradio.com. If you've got a question for Wilma, include that as well, and we'll be back in a minute. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Susie Larson. This is The Promise, talking to mother and author Wilma Dirksen. Her book is titled The Way of Letting Go, One Woman's Walk Toward Forgiveness. And her dear daughter, Candace, at 13 years old, was abducted, tied up, and put in a shed, and she died of hypothermia, and it was a wretched, horrible crime. Wilma and her hubby and family went 7 weeks not knowing what had happened to Candace, and even now, all these years later, still waiting for justice to be served. You said something, Wilma, before the break that kind of caught my ear. You talked about two kinds of fear, good fear and trauma fear. Say more, if you would.
Well, good fear is adrenaline giving. It comes with usually a challenge and excitement, and we pay good money to play with fear. We go to movies that get our hearts going. We watch hockey games and football, and you know, we're in the game, right? We love the excitement and the challenges and all of that. But the trauma fear is when the level of adrenaline is too much for us. We all have different tolerances of the levels of fear that we can tolerate. And when it gets too much and we want to get rid of the fear and we go into rage, most anger is based in fear. And rage is never a good form of an emotion when it's over the top. Again, anger is good, but the rage of being out of control, or the fear that leads to wanting control everything around us, obsessive compulsive natures and people who want to control other people. We can control ourselves, but not everyone else around us. And when we want to destroy anything that creates fear with us, and we become very violent towards it. And the ultimate part of it is also paralyzing. Fear mm-hmm. can just imprison us, so that rather than go and check out fear or what's happening, we will recede into ourselves and almost remain in a prison within ourselves. Those are just some of the examples of good and bad fear.
So a person could probably discern pretty easily the difference between good or trauma fear happening within them. I mean, either they're motivated by this adrenaline fear, or they're completely paralyzed by it in a traumatic way that's making them sick to their stomach. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. You referenced a quote from a woman named Shannon Alder, I believe her name is. I want to read this from your book and have you comment on it. She writes, "Before you can live, a part of you has to die. You have to let go of what could have been, how you should have acted, and what you wish you would have said differently. You have to accept that you can't change the past experiences, opinions of others at the time, at that moment in time, or outcomes from their choices or yours. From this point, you will finally be free." I mean, that's a powerful statement. How did that prove to be true for you?
Well, letting go helps us move on. I think another example of that would be a goalie is supposed to be one of the people that can forgive and let go the quickest. You know, the puck comes, and if it gets into the net, or if it doesn't, even if it hurts or whatever, they have to let go of that moment very quickly to face the challenge of the next puck that's coming. And so that is kind of what happens with something like murder. Everything was coming at us, and at the end of day, you know, the blame, the guilt, the fear, all of the emotions, and I've identified 15 of these emotions that can just destroy us, have to be gone through very quickly, otherwise we can't sleep. And the Bible is clear that we should get rid of, you know, clear up our lives before we go to sleep. We need to wash our feet and let go of things so that we can feel peaceful at the end of that. At the end of day. That doesn't mean we solve everything, but we come to some kind of resolution of how we're going to deal with it the next day.
Wow. I thought it was interesting how, I don't remember if it was a grief support group director, leader, but somebody asking you about coming in to talk, but they put a caveat, but don't talk about forgiveness. Did I get that right? Did I remember that right?
Yes. Well, because what happened was that the day that Candace's body was found, a man came and said, you know, your life is over because I'm a parent of a murdered child, and I know the trauma. And so he told us for 2 hours of what to expect, this huge trauma abyss. So Cliff and I were just so frightened. We chose the word forgiveness, and it inadvertently came out the next day when we did the press conference. People said, okay, what are you going to do about the offender? And Cliff and I just said, oh, we're going to forgive. We totally didn't think about what that word would mean to different people and how the different understanding. So it was well known that we were intending to forgive, and it's a word of judgment. It's a very, very difficult word for anybody who's experienced huge victimization. And they called it the F word.
Wow.
And just said, you know, I wanted to be part of the group, and they liked what I was, and they wanted me to be part of the group. But they said I had to leave the F word at the door, and they didn't hear about it.
You know, and I'm sure that process is just grueling and takes time and looks different on everybody. But even Malcolm Gladwell, who wrote your introduction, you know, kind of juxtaposed your story to another man's story. And he said, you know, 25 years later, the man still raged with such hatred that, you know, he was taken aback by it. And again, he wasn't judgmental about it, just saying, I mean, how would you ever navigate the loss of a child? So there's no judgment there. But the fact is, you know, that hatred and rage, if it's not let go of, it will poison you and destroy you. So talk about that. Was the process for you and your husband like 100 times a day? Or what did that look like for you so you could get to a place of peace in your heart?
Oh, it's a process. We get angry about 14 times a day, the research tells us.
Mm.
So it is a process of what alerts that anger for us and on that kind of thing. But it's, I think on big things, though, it's a choice to say, okay, I'm going to forgive. I don't know what that means right now, but I want to go, this is the natural way of doing things. I want to do it counterintuitive. I want to do something different because letting go and forgiveness is always counterintuitive. So there's always a moment of choice. I'm not going to hit him. I am going to do it in a different way. There's got to be another way. And in some ways, I said we need to do that for every day. But in some ways also, it takes time. And we might choose to do it, and then the next day we might really grieve the loss that we've got. And sometimes we have to give up a lot. Like for me to give up the happy ending to my story, I just remember getting all these gorgeous Christmas cards that during the time that Candace was disappeared. And they all had these wonderful family photos. And I kind of just tore up those family photos of my friends because I just so upset that I knew that our family photo would never include Candace ever again. Huge. And it just ripped me apart. So it's not that easy.
No.
And I'm not talking about just saying, okay, it's going to be okay. No, it hurts like the dickens. And I just cried and I ripped those up and I felt. And I told my friends too. I mean, it wasn't as if it was against them. It was just something that I needed to say that this is hurting. And but then slowly to realize that this is something that's a reality. And then to embrace the fact that Candace is no longer with us. That usually takes time of grief. And then once we have really given it up, that's where God steps in. I think God is, in my experience, God seems to be charmed when we as victims give it up. He comes in and moves very softly.
Mm.
And he says, yes, you've given something up, but there's something else now here. And that's where we discovered that even though Candace was gone, her memory was still with us. And even though she had taken on a different form, that didn't mean she was gone. And she's still, 33 years later, very much an active force in our lives.
And you'll see her again, and your time with her in heaven will be much longer than your time without her on earth, you know?
Exactly. Mm. There's so much comfort, so much comfort when we've given it up.
Yeah, wow. So this one was interesting to me, letting go of my ego. Say more about that one.
Oh, ego brings suffering all the time.
Yeah.
Again, you know, we have such a huge self-interest and survival. And it just it's such a force, right? And and we're always about me. And when often the answer is in us. It's not about, the answer isn't in me only as an individual. The answer is in what is the collective good. And even in myself, there are four parts to me, right? I'm a body, mind, spirit, and heart. And my heart might say something, but my body might say, no, it's not good for me. So giving up that inner desire to just, it's all about me and all about my rights, just to say, no, I have to give up my ego and do the collective, consider everyone else involved. And that's tough. Oof, that's tough.
Boy, is it ever. How about this one, letting go of my narrow faith?
Well, I think so much so often we want to believe in a God that's a bit of a Santa Claus, who, if we do the right thing, then we're gonna have a good life. And oh, I had been so good, and Cliff and I hadn't even smoked. I hadn't kissed the boy until I wanted to marry him. Oh, I was so good. I thought I deserved a, and I wanted to be a missionary, and we had been, and Cliff had been passed. Like we would, oh, we had just been so good. And then you realize, no, there's no promise like that. There's no promise that it's all going to work out. In fact, God says, Jesus says, take up your cross and follow me. That means there's always suffering.
Yeah.
And suffering isn't God never doesn't want us to suffer. That wasn't his first intention in the Garden of Eden. But because of circumstances, suffering is now part of the program. And God is in that suffering, and his promise is that he turns all of our suffering into something beautiful. But that takes time.
Yeah, definitely. So, Wilma, you know, all these years later, when you see something that reminds you of Candace and the grief just comes, feels like it's going to swallow you alive, what do you do with it? Do you let it kind of play out? Do you kind of wrap your arms around it, or do you do something different with it?
Good grief is always comes in waves, and it's always good to know that. Sadness that, and so, it's, and the way you deal with a wave is just let it come and wash over you. Just let the tears come. And so I don't fight my grief. I just think, oh, this is Candace is coming. And just let it come. Good grief is waves of emotion, and that means they will come over us and then leave and wash us clean. So it's how you know. There's always the tug and the feeling of tears is always painful, but the feeling of actually feeling Candace again after 33 years is really a gift. And because she's so well known in the city and everywhere, she is good to. After 33 years, it's so good to be able to still to talk about her and feel her with other people. So often people, when we lose them, no one wants to talk about them again. And that is another kind of grief that's very lonely. So I feel very blessed to feel this very raw grief 33 years after her death.
Wow. Talking to Wilma Dirksen, title of her book, The Way of Letting Go, One Woman's Walk Toward Forgiveness. We've got three copies. Email if you want in on the drawing and include a question if you've got one for Wilma. Susie@myfaithradio.com. Do remember that mailing address. When we come back, we'll talk about other parts and ways of letting go. Letting go of the old me. Letting go of my expectation that life is fair. That's a tough one, isn't it? Letting go of my guilt and blame. Here's another one. Letting go of my need to know. And Wilma writes this, worry occurs when we assume responsibility for things that are outside our control. We'll have more great conversation up ahead. Don't go away. We'll be back in a minute. Really, really glad you tuned in today. I'm Susie Larson. This is The Promise, talking to Wilma Dirksen. She's author of the book, The Way of Letting Go, One Woman's Walk Toward Forgiveness. And she suffered what no parent ever wants to suffer. Her daughter, her 13-year-old daughter, back in 1984, was abducted, tied up, left in a shed, and died of hypothermia. And there's more to the story than that. But, of course, Wilma's world collapsed. And she's just emerged out of the ashes and sorting through grief and loss. She's learned some really profound things for all of us. Whether you've lost a child or you've suffered some kind of major heartbreak and disappointment, life hasn't turned out like you thought it would. We have disappointments, we have hurts, and we've got to deal with them. The title of her book, again, is The Way of Letting Go. And let's talk, if we can, about one of the aspects of letting go. You talk about the letting go of the old me. Say more.
Well, I think I realized that the old me was gone when the man came to our door on the day that Candace's body was found, and he said, I, too, am a parent of a murdered child. And my own reaction to him was, oh, no. Mm. I thought, oh, I have no social equity anymore.
Wow.
I'm not going to be any fun anymore. It's just such a doom and gloom kind of title, and it hasn't, you know, it's stayed with me. I still am known as a parent of a murdered child. And, you know, it was tough because at one point I wanted to go run away and I wanted to be a real estate agent. And the very first house I was showing, the man went through all the emotions and at the end said, you know, I don't want to buy this house. I wanted to talk to you because my daughter was murdered.
Oh, my.
Oh, it intruded on everything I did. And so I had to finally say, okay, I am a parent of a murdered child. Now, what is this all about? I'm going to do it well. So I started to study the issues. I started to talk about it. I started to examine it all. And you know, my values changed. And just realized, you know, it's my old me is gone. And maybe the new me has a meaning too. But I'm going to have to create some of that. And as it's turned out, I think I have lived a very rich life just because of the platform that I have been given. But it there is a death involved where the old me had to go.
Wow. Wow. Okay, so I'll talk about this one. This is a big one for everybody, I would say. Letting go of my expectation that life is fair.
Oh, we want life to be fair. We want there to be justice. We want there to be an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. You know, we want there to be some kind of consequence, you know, something that, a kind of rhythm and a kind of organization to life, and then to realize that there is no connection. There is, you know, people who are wonderful can suffer greatly, and, you know, it just takes away all sense of security and confidence that I can determine what's going to happen to me, and we can't. I remember the Crown called us just before we were going to go into a bail hearing or something. I don't know, there was going to be a shift in schedule, and we were going to go on a cruise, and I just blew up. I says, he's in control. And you're in control. The systems are controlling our lives. The Crown said something very sweet to me. He said, you know, I've learned in life that there are certain things you can't control, and you worry about the things that you can control. And that is kind of what I've had to learn to do, like the whole trial process. You know what? Okay, I have no way, or I can't demand. I can't demand that there is a rhythm and a rhyme to life. I just have to see what happens and then do the best with the time and the controls that I have.
And let's remember, too, as Kingdom people, that we say this often on the show, that life on earth is short. Eternity is long. And Jesus did say we would suffer here. It's going to be hard. We're on a pilgrimage. We're not made for this world. We're made for another world. So whatever we suffer here will pale in comparison to the glory that will be revealed to us later. And I think that's one of the only ways we can keep marching is to say, yep, life's not fair. It is hard. But God keeps good records, and he is a God of justice. And one day he's going to make everything right. He's going to make it right again. And we keep our eyes, we fix our eyes on the reality of heaven and the faithfulness of God's character. And I don't know, that helps me continue to march.
Oh, definitely. There is going to be justice.
Yes.
And a sense that the realization that, and in my own experience, I've realized that there were times when I thought something needed to happen, and in hindsight, it was the wrong thing. So there's also a realization that God is very interested in justice. But thank goodness he is, because he's the one that can do it the best.
Yeah.
He
Amen.
Knows everybody's heart. Sometimes we just have to wait. And even here, allow for God to work that justice out in his miraculous ways, but it takes patience.
Mm. Well, another thing I mentioned at the open of the show is our own propensity towards self-contempt and blame, where, you know, we rehearse and rehash our own mistakes. And I've just learned that it is so bad for your soul, it's bad for your life, it's even bad for your health. To hold yourself in contempt. So you write about this, letting go of my guilt and blame. Speak to that one.
Well, I think I've talked a bit about my own guilt, but I think it's so wrong always to try and find a reason for everything that's everything bad that happens. And we can do so much harm by blaming other people, and we do it so quickly, and it's so easily done. You know, if something's gone wrong, we want a scapegoat. We want to find somebody who we I think research shows that we'll try and find somebody that we want to get rid of, somebody that's vulnerable to us, and somebody that we can, you know, and we don't do it wisely. So blame is so destructive. And we want to just put it into one ball, all of our stuff and all of our baggage, and we want to just, you know, aim it at somebody, anybody, and it can be so destructive. And I've often wondered what it would be like if we had a world with no blame, where we would just accept everybody and work together to solve the problems. Not that, you know, we need justice, we need to hold each other responsible, but to do it with love. Love first, justice second.
Mm, wow. Here's another one. Letting go of my need to know. I mean, there's been a number of times throughout my faith journey where I've just sensed God's whisper to my heart, you're on a need to know basis, and when you need to know, I'll let you know. And there's just times where you feel like you are flying blind, but that is what faith is. And I would think that's especially the case when you're waiting for justice. And it seems like, of course, you can't control all the variables, all the missing pieces. And so there's a lot that you don't know and a lot that you can't control. How do you let go then?
That's really tough, because you have to let go of knowing. And for us, that showed itself in who took Candace. And I just remember the afternoon when Cyrus and I had gone shopping, that's my little son, and we were taking the groceries in, and a neighbor bent over the fence and said, "Hi, little guy, how are you doing?" And Cyrus just kept on marching into the house. So I followed him and says, "Why did you do that? He's a nice man." And then my son said, "Is he a neighbor or is he a stranger?" And it just hit me. Who is he? Who do we blame? And it makes a difference of how we're going to relate to them. If I was, and he could have, our neighbor would have been somebody that could have done this. So just kind of say, you know, we don't want to blame. We don't want to blame unnecessarily, unless we know for a fact blaming is an unnecessary bondage or wall that we create. And I had to not blame. I had to be cautious with my children. But I couldn't just, and so I told my son, and this is, again, I just was crying. I turned away so he wouldn't see me. I just cried and I said, "He's a neighbor." My heart was just filled with fear, thinking, what if I had just made my son vulnerable to a stranger? And that was the kind of thing I had to do all the time, is to try and say, you know, I'm not going to blame just anybody. I'm not going to be irresponsible in my blaming. My blame has to have evidence. And even if it takes 33 years of going through a trial and seeing all the evidence, it's worth the wait, because we don't want to do it irresponsibly or too quickly.
Wow. Well, we could do a whole show on that, you know, not to blame quickly and irresponsibly, because we've become experts at that, I think, in our nation anyway. As we wrap up here, Wilma, thank you, first of all, for stewarding your pain and your story so beautifully. I'm wondering if you'd pray for that person who's maybe wrapped up in a ball right now of anxiety and fear because of hard, hard things. Would you pray for that person?
Oh, dear God, you are so close to us, and you know how susceptible we are to fear and anxiety. And I just pray for those that are listening right now that are dealing with anxiety. Oh, it's so crippling, and it's so such a fierce enemy in our lives. And I just pray that you'll just loose the bonds, draw near, touch them, feel their comfort them, so that they can feel your presence and allow the fears and the anxieties to be released to new joy and new light. Oh, God, bless them. We pray for everybody that's listening to us right now. We've all got stuff. And God, you're there just behind us, whispering in our ears. Whisper to us, dear Lord. Amen.
Amen. Wilma, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Susie. This was wonderful.
What a dear heart you are. Well, you've been listening to Live the Promise. I'm Susie Larson. And in just a bit, you'll find a podcast of today's program up on our website at myfaithradio.com. Remember this, too. The Lord wants you to last long and finish strong. And He is the one who keeps you strong to the end. Have a great day. Thanks for listening to this conversation from Live the Promise. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend. Help grow the impact of the show. Also, if you would, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player, and then never miss a show.